Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our writers from the issue read out their pieces for you. First up this week, you can hear Matthew Lynn talk about why Europe is so behind on its own vaccination programme. He'll then be followed by Will Noland, the Eton teacher who was sacked and has since sparked a free speech row. At the very end, you'll hear from historian Mary Wellesley on the hermits who hid away for the sake of religion. First up, Matthew Lynn.
It was about as grovelling as a letter can get. In June, the health ministers of Germany, France, Italy and the Netherlands were forced by their respective chancellors and prime ministers to write to the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, apologising for their efforts to buy COVID-19 vaccines on behalf of their health systems. It was, they conceded, of utmost importance to have a common, single and joint approach to the various pharmaceutical companies. At that moment, with the new coronavirus raging across Europe and economies in lockdown, the EU was busily putting together a plan that would make sure that if and when a vaccine became available, the continent's citizens would be the first to get the shot. When it comes to fighting the global pandemic, there is no place for me first, argued von der Leyen when she announced the scheme, before pointing out that harmful competition for scarce resources should be avoided. Instead, budgets should be pooled and the mighty buying and regulatory power of the world's largest trading bloc would secure access and terms far better than any could individually. Smaller countries, such as a typically eccentric UK, which opted out of the scheme, would be left to fend for themselves as best they could. It would be a powerful symbol of how the EU could protect its citizens from the gravest threat in a generation. Vaccine nationalism would be crushed for the common good. Fast forward 7 months, however, and it is clear that it is not working out quite as planned. Europe is falling woefully behind in the race to vaccinate its citizens. Uğur Şahin, the founder of the German company BioNTech, which jointly created the first jab with Pfizer, has revealed that a slow, bumbling, arrogant EU failed to order enough supplies, while approvals have been sluggish and the rollout across the continent has barely begun. In truth, the vaccination campaign is turning into the greatest EU catastrophe since the Euro crisis of 2010 to 2011. And while that only bankrupted three countries and condemned a generation of Greeks to poverty, this one will result in the deaths of tens of thousands of people. The facts are clear enough. At the time of writing, tiny Israel has carried out 1.2 million vaccinations, or 13% of its population, the US 4.6 million, and Britain 1.3 million. But Germany has managed only 265,000, Italy 128,000, and France a mere 516. Even Russia, hardly anyone's idea of an advanced state, has managed 800,000. Worse, it doesn't look as if the situation will change any time soon. According to Şahin, the EU orders so few doses of the BioNTech shot in the summer that it is now at the back of the queue for scarce supplies. Meanwhile, the vaccine it has ordered in big quantities, the Oxford-AstraZeneca shot, has not even started the EU approval process, even though it has already been sanctioned in Britain and India. It might be the end of 2021 before Europe is vaccinated, and perhaps even 2022. Unsurprisingly, people are starting to get angry. Markus Söder, the leader of the Bavarian Christian Social Union, sister party of Angela Merkel's ruling CDU, blasted the programme at the weekend. It is difficult to explain that a very good vaccine is developed in Germany, but is inoculated more quickly elsewhere, he said. The Italians are complaining that the Germans have stolen their supplies, while the Finnish health minister complained the country received only 10,000 doses in the first batch. So what went wrong? There were, as so often, three big problems. People, politics and bureaucracy. The EU has long harboured ambitions to take control of health policy, at the moment still reserved in the main for the member states. COVID-19 presented the perfect opportunity. The virus, kind of obviously, has no great respect for national borders. It crosses them with ease. The crisis was a perfect moment for the EU to bounce back from Brexit and take charge of coping with the epidemic with a transnational strategy based on science and cooperation. It would be a magnificent demonstration of the EU at its best, delivering for its citizens. It was hardly surprising that the Commission was so anxious to stop national health ministers buying their own supplies. The trouble is, the people in charge were not up to it. In Germany, von der Leyen was notorious for a spell as Germany's defence minister that was characterised by a string of procurement scandals and disasters. The Bundeswehr concluded she was hopelessly out of her depth. Buying military and medical supplies is very similar, with the admittedly significant difference that one is designed to end lives and the other to save them. Both involve lots of complex, expensive contracts struck in an emergency for stuff you aren't yet sure works. Putting von der Leyen in charge of vaccine procurement was a little like getting Gavin Williamson to run the British effort. You can hardly be surprised if things start to go wrong. Nor did the EU's health commissioner inspire much confidence. Stella Kyriakides was appointed in 2019 after a brief career in Cypriot politics. If no disrespect to the Mediterranean island, and best known for a ramshackle blend of tourism and Russian money laundering, and a population of less than a million, it is hardly the place to prepare for an administrative task on the scale of vaccinating Europe. So it turned out. The EU was too late to the party, placing too few orders and at the wrong moment. Its initial budget for buying vaccines was just over 2 billion euros. In comparison, the UK, with 66 million people instead of 448 million, is set to spend 12 billion purchasing, manufacturing and deploying vaccines. The EU's strategy was to pool its buying power to stop the drugs companies exploiting it. But in fact, the vaccines are pretty cheap. The Oxford AstraZeneca jab is just £3 a shot. At £20, the Pfizer vaccine is still great value. It would cost the UK about 2.4 billion to vaccinate everyone. Speed was the real issue. The money was largely irrelevant. Even worse, politics got in the way. Germany's Der Spiegel has made the explosive allegation that France insisted the EU couldn't buy more of the BioNTech jab than the one its national champion, Sanofi, was working on. But the Sanofi vaccine stumbled, making that worthless. As Sahin has revealed, the EU assumed that it would have a whole range of vaccines to choose from and became complacent. Finally, the European Medicines Agency has been painfully slow. Ironically, Britain's own health regulator took advice from a Munich-based consultancy, Biopharma Excellence, on speeding up the regulatory process. As with the vaccine itself, plenty of German expertise, brilliant as always, has been deployed everywhere except in Germany. The EMA, the EU's health regulator, approved the Pfizer vaccine before Christmas, but only under pressure from Berlin and weeks after the UK. There is no sign of approval for the Oxford vaccine, even though it is the only one that has been ordered in bulk. The EMA says that AstraZeneca hasn't submitted its application yet. It doesn't seem to occur to anyone to pick up the phone and ask. EU institutions still see their role as blocking what could be dangerous innovations. No one has stopped to wonder if sometimes, such as in a pandemic, for example, it might be better to encourage technology. But that's bureaucracy. It sticks to the script long after it stops making sense. In truth, VaccineGate, as it is starting to be known in Germany and elsewhere, is turning into a rerun of the Euro crisis. The EU, as so often, wiggles the ends, but then hopelessly fails to put together the means to deliver them. It created a single currency with none of the mechanisms in place to make it work. This time around, it has created a health policy, but without the budgets or the expertise to deliver it. Perhaps the most important lesson is this. The EU is governed by the idea that bigger is always better, and that cooperation is always better than competition. But it is clear that when it comes to creating and rolling out vaccines, that is far from true.
That was Matthew Lynn. And now, Will Noland.
One of the things I'll miss about teaching at Eton is the ever-present threat of an ironic riposte from one of the boys. Cheer up, I told one who looked unenthused by Milton in my first week at the school, 9 years ago. 200 years ago, you'd have been down a mine. Sir, he replied deadpan, we'd have owned the mines. The class erupted in self-deprecating laughter. I'd arrived. It was the boys themselves who suggested and named the YouTube channel Noland Knows, which has since got me summarily dismissed. The axe fell swiftly after I asked why a video entitled The Patriarchy Paradox, originally intended as half of a debate on the new gender orthodoxies at the college, which never saw the light of day, should be deleted from this public platform. The reason given was the presence of an Eton disclaimer on the channel, originally added at the college's own request. I've since been called everything from a free speech martyr to a misogynist. While the video has received views equivalent to more than 100 times the size of the Eton student body, it was the boys themselves who first came to my defence, with a compelling open letter saying that they felt morally bound not to be bystanders in what appears to be an instance of institutional bullying. They boldly claimed that young men and their views are formed in the meeting and conflict of ideas, and correctly pinpointed free speech as the principle at stake. Otherwise, why was it so essential the video should come down? They had already sensed the need to resist a drastic narrowing of debate in the schoolroom, which has reportedly led them to set up private debating groups to test viewpoints forbidden in class. Their wit seems to have inoculated them against being wholly ventriloquized by the new regime blighting the school. "But sir," deadpan again, "I thought the college was meant to be diverse." My disciplinary process was only the latest in a series of lustrations turning Eton into a stifling monoculture. One master, since cleared of all wrongdoing without being reinstated, found himself facing the very disciplinary procedures, the fairness and viability of which he had initially questioned. When justice dies, irony soon follows. Yet, as Lenin knew, the educational value of courts is tremendous. At my hearing, two of the three senior teachers specified as disciplinary panelists by the college's constitution were the headmaster's new appointments to his inner circle, and the third was his own deputy. The college had lawyers present, at one point attempting to replace a fellow with an external QC, while I did not. A colleague's character witness statement was significantly altered, being restored to its original only after she protested in writing. Only in response to pressure did the school provide an external note taker. A lie, as James Callaghan said, can be halfway round the world before the truth has got its boots on. And so it was that the provost, once described as apt to mislead in the pages of the Scott Inquiry, tried to quell the public outpouring of disquiet around my case by suggesting the video had breached the Equality Act. But neither the college's initial legal advice nor my dismissal letter claimed anything of the sort. It was not new legislation I transgressed, just a new religion with an old-time zeal to suppress dissent and punish heresy. The college's approach to equality and diversity, which it finally claimed I had breached, has never been explained to staff, making it impossible to follow. The boy who wrote to me afterwards saying he wished more could have been done to defend my case needn't have felt so bad. Victor Klemperer wrote in The Language of the Third Reich that words are like tiny doses of arsenic, swallowed unnoticed, and then after a while the toxic reaction sets in. And so diversity demands conformity. Inclusion is only for those already in the group. Tolerance cannot bear tradition. And lived experience counts for some, not for others. With the headmaster threatening to refer me to the teaching regulation agency, potentially banning me from the classroom for life, at least I can be grateful to COVID for boosting demand for my online tutoring. While not making such threats, or pursuing tendentious prevent referrals, he offers empty platitudes about free speech thriving at Eton. Maybe so, just don't expect to keep your livelihood afterwards.
That was Will Noland, and finally, Mary Wellesley.
At a time when so many of us are experiencing some measure of isolation, it is hard to fathom the choice to live in extreme confinement in the middle of the urban bustle. But hermits were once unremarkable features of England's cities. The 13th century traveller entering London from the north at Cripplegate would have walked within yards of a hermit's cell. There were also cells at Aldgate, Bishopsgate, Temple Bar and Cornhill, as well as many others beyond the city limits. These hermits, more properly called anchorites or anchoresses, permanently enclosed themselves in cells attached to churches in order to live a life of prayer and contemplation. The word comes from the Greek anachorein, meaning to retire or retreat. In their cells, anchorites lived a life of extraordinary restriction. They had a small window which looked onto the church, another which led onto a servant's parlour, through which they could receive food and get rid of waste, and a third onto the churchyard or street, from which they could dispense spiritual counsel. They were otherwise confined to a single room for what could be decades. Life as an anchorite began with a death. After processing from the church as the choir sang In Paradisum Deducant Te Angeli, traditionally sung as a body is conveyed to a grave, the recludensis, the novice recluse, would arrive at the cell and climb into a ready-dug grave, where they were sprinkled with earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, before the door of the cell was bolted. When they died, they would likely be buried in this very grave. Life inside the cell was one of sensory deprivation, with limited light, fresh air, conversation or laughter, and devoid of touch or exercise. To volunteer for this life is almost unthinkable now, but there were around 200 anchorites across the country in the 13th century. Women outnumbered men by as much as 3 to 1. Perhaps the most famous English recluse was the anchoress Julian of Norwich, who was enclosed in a cell in the heart of Norwich. In 1373, before she was enclosed, she had a near-death experience, which culminated in a series of 15 visions of God. She recovered and lived for around another 40 years. Soon after her experience, she composed her Revelations of Divine Love. The work is important not simply because it is the first in English that we can be certain was authored by a woman, but also because she was a writer of exceptional quality. Her prose is characterized by its elegant rhetorical structure. In spite of this, it never feels scholarly or obtuse. Instead, it is a work of clarity and empathy. Given the privation of her life, the work is strikingly, almost radically hopeful. She never explicitly refers to her enclosure. At one point, she writes that this place is prison and this life is penance, but she was likely referring to her life on earth rather than the confines of her cell. Her work is instead suffused with optimism, exemplified by her most famous line, "All shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well." Julian's work is a message of hope in darkness, which speaks to us across the centuries.
That was Mary Wellesley. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud, and do join us again next week.